This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 265 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by two co-hosts. First, we have, from the Jetwine blog, Rob Mark.
Is this where I'm supposed to say something, or? Oh, yeah. It's snowing. It's snowing in Chicago. I mean, there are, really.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah, there's 4 inches of snow out here. Wow. I mean, no, there's... There's 14 inches of snow right outside.
You're just razzing me because of this whole weather thing, aren't you?
Yeah, and that and the cicadas, it probably makes people wonder what that is in the background here.
All right, well, also joining us, hopefully without snow, and I know without cicadas, is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, everybody. Greetings from Philadelphia. What? You want me to add something?
No. That's fine. That's fine. I was just going to say, David's being brief because he wants to get to a football game.
My Eagles are playing the Redskins, so and unfortunately, it's Monday night football starting at 6:55. Thank God it goes to normal hours next week.
You know I'm a Redskins fan, David, having lived outside D.C. for all those years.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, you know, sorry. but in all fairness, you and I had a lovely weekend on Saturday at Wings and Wheels, didn't we?
We did. That's at Wings Field, right, in Bluebell, Pennsylvania?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, these two airplane geeks were slobbering over the cars than the airplanes.
Yeah, they had some really nice automobiles there. So, but that's great. I think it's an annual event that they hold there to benefit Angel Flight East, so it's nice to kind of participate in something that has sort of charitable benefit. And Angel Flight East is a fantastic organization, as well as all the other Angel Flight organizations around the country. So those guys do good work, and there's other organizations that do similar kinds of things. And that, of course, is provide transport for patients who can't otherwise afford it. And typically this is done by pilots who volunteer their time and use their own aircraft to fly folks to hospitals. So it's great work being done by those guys. All right. Our guest this episode is Brent Owens. Now, Brent's a professional pilot, and he's also a flight operations manager at a large corporate flight department. He flies a Falcon 2000. And I guess he also flies a desk during the day. But at night, he writes about general aviation topics on his two blogs, Fixed Wing Buddha and I Fly Blog. So, Brent, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thanks. And, it's great weather here in the Buckeye State, and it's been beautiful. Love it here.
That's great. Yeah, Ohio is a fantastic place, pretty place. I lived there when I was very small. But have been back several times. It's a great state. Now, I understand you also have some activity with the EAA, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a tech counselor for the EAA and also a flight advisor. I was actually a vice president. I had to step down from that, just too busy with everything else going on. But yeah, we have a pretty active chapter here in Central Ohio, Chapter 9. So it's one of the older chapters around, and they do a lot of great work. They're involved in Young Eagles pretty heavily, and they usually try to have the tri-motor in town and that kind of thing. So they do a nice job.
And we'll talk some more about that coming up. But also we should mention that you built your own airplane as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I built a Vans RV-8. So I'm one of those guys. But no, it's been a great airplane. I really struggled trying to choose what airplane to build. And I just needed something that could do a little bit of everything well. And that's how I ended up with the RV, and I've been loving it, flying it for the last 2 years, and I'm no regrets.
Oh, that sounds great. And coming up after the news, when we talk with you in more detail, I want to ask you some questions about that RV8, including who should be building their own and who should not. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. So
sounds great.
Coming up before that, though, in the news, we have a number of items to talk about. The furloughed United pilots are returning to work. Also, we're going to talk about general aviation growth in China, the disaster that is air shows in the U.S., and Bombardier is selling Flexjet. And then we're also going to touch briefly on some malware that's going after the aviation industry. Also coming up, we have David's Airplane of the Week, I think. David, what do we have this time?
Well, it's not an airplane, I don't know. A glider is an airplane, or an airplane doesn't necessarily have to be a glider, but a glider is an airplane. We're going to do the Schweitzer 232. I figured we'd do something different per our guests, and we're going to talk about gliding.
All right, that's cool. I love gliding. Steve and Grant are off this week, so no Australia desk report, but we do have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson. He talks with Jason Smart, who's written a book about what it took for him to learn how to fly. And then we have, oh boy, do we have lots of listener mail, including some recorded messages, and I'm sure more than we're going to have time for, but we'll try to do as much of that as we can. So with all that, why don't we get started, guys? Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay, United Airlines. Well, United Airlines in 2008 furloughed 950 of their flight deck workforce. And then in 2009, they furloughed 500 more. Well, with this recall of 600 pilots, all of the furloughed United pilots will have been offered their jobs back. Now, we saw a lot of airlines laying off pilots in 2001, after the events of that year and that the effect that had on traveling, and also after the 2008 recession. So there have been a lot of pilots that have been furloughed. Rob, I think this is pretty good news that United is bringing back the rest of their furloughed pilots.
It is for the people that are on that list, I'll tell you that, if they want to work. But I think what it does say, too, though, is that we're into the hiring mode for these airlines now. I mean, we'll have to check with some of the big authorities on the actual numbers. But when you've finished asking all the furloughed people if they want to come back and you have no one left, you'd better be in a hiring mode. And so I think that's, of course, that's been the case for United anyway. But it's nice to see them all come back. It would be interesting, of the 14 or so hundred, how many of them actually accept the offer? Because very often a lot of them will bypass it and just not come back.
Well, yeah, I would imagine that a certain number of them will have moved on to other things when you're furloughed year after year or for a number of years that you don't want to go without, and so you need to find something to do. And some may have just changed careers.
Well, that's true. Flying jobs have been a little tougher to come by. I mean, some have probably moved into business aviation. But typically a lot of business aviation flight departments don't really like to hire airline pilots that they know still have a seniority number.
Well, it's interesting. According to this article in ATW Online, the pilots that have come back, that they have brought back by United, they've positioned them with Continental up to this point anyway. And the other interesting thing is that their motivation for recalling these remaining 600 isn't to support growth in the airline so much as it is to backfill positions that are resulting from retirements.
Yeah, and that's again, that's the key, is that this is not a growth issue, and while all the carriers are smarter this time and kind of hang on to their growth plans, and which is why we have load factors of, I don't know, 90 something percent. You can never find an empty seat on an airplane. There's going to come a time where they're going to probably grow, And I think everybody knows that it's a matter of when.
That's right. Yeah. And there's some other things that are changing, too. We have the mandatory retirement at age 65. And we also have coming up next year in 2014 some new FAA rules that start to give pilots more rest time. So if pilots have to take more rest time, that's less work time, which means you need more pilots to compensate for that.
Unless they start allowing them to nap in the cockpit occasionally.
You mean officially nap in the cockpit? No, I'm sure they don't nap in the cockpit. Also, ALPA has a merger policy that specifies that an arbitration panel, a three-member arbitration panel, is created to develop a binding merged seniority list.
And that just happened, didn't it?
Happened last week, right.
That's right.
So now, I don't know what happened. I guess now the fun comes, and presumably there could be some reallocation or rearranging of pilots to planes, and I don't know if that also impacts their rank, if some captains become first officers and vice versa based on this new combined seniority.
Well, I would hope not. I mean, there certainly have been some shuffles around. I mean, here in Chicago, we had all of United's 747 400 fleet disappear, maybe 6 months ago, and they moved them all out to San Francisco. And they assumed that all the pilots or a lot of them would just go out there, and that didn't happen. And O'Hare was pretty much a 777 base. And I guess United, based on this new list, or maybe it was coincidental, decided that maybe they need to bring the 747 400s back to Chicago. So they're going to have some of those out here again, which some of the friends of mine that fly them just can't. They're doing backflips. They're so excited because didn't like 777 anyway. They call it a light twin. There's something I bet you'd like, Brent.
Yeah, that sounds right up my alley. You know, I've got a friend of mine that works for a major, and he went through a merger recently, and boy, he's sour grapes about the whole deal. And mostly it's because he's the smaller of the two companies that merged, and I think those guys might have came up a little short, you know, at least his particular situation. So I'm sure I'm sure it's not bad for everyone, but it seems like the stories I've heard, generally someone's losing on those in terms of the pilot workforce anyway.
Yeah, I don't think you can have a merge of any kind without winners and losers.
Yeah.
The winners often say, well, you know, they feel bad for the other folks, but not nearly as bad as the folks that are the losers.
Yeah, right.
And I guess on the one remaining legacy merger, we still have to wait until that plays out in court. I guess that's scheduled for November to address that issue.
Yeah, they want that decided. Should we take money on whether the American U.S. Air merger goes? I have $10 as if it doesn't happen.
I think it might happen. I'm optimistic.
And I'm totally on the fence. Usually I've got an opinion one way or the other, but boy, it's really hard for me to tell. If it doesn't go through, if the merger is disallowed, then I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, I just don't see how they can do that after letting, you know, the other big legacy carriers get together. It seems, you know, like an unfair, you know, situation if they don't, you know, continue that.
That's precisely why they don't want to let them do it.
Yeah.
Because they're afraid that it's much too concentrated. I mean, maybe they will if they give up enough territory there at Washington National, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Can I ask, being the military av geek that doesn't work in the industry, can I ask a dumb question?
It wouldn't be the first, so go ahead, David.
Okay, Rob, what effect does it mean to be furloughed, and what does it mean to come back? In my real day job industry, there would be no such thing. You're either out the door, and you're forever out the door. Furloughed is a kind of a strange term for me.
It's a good question, actually, David. And furlough essentially means that the chief pilot comes in and says, guess what? We're not going to be able to put you on the schedule for a little bit because we don't have enough airplanes to fly or enough routes to fly to keep you busy. And but we know things might change. So if you'd like, we'll keep your seniority number in the same place it was. And then when business gets better, we can bring you back on. But in the meantime, you don't get anything. You don't get any money, usually any benefits, nothing at all. So the only hook is someday you may come back, but then again, someday you may not. And that's the risk that, you know, that they take. I mean, I saw something today on the, I think it was the New York Times, that was talking about airlines since deregulation, and they said it was well over 200 airlines have failed since 1979 in the United States. So that's... It's a lot of people that saw seniority numbers just, you know, vaporize. But you're right, David. I don't know any other industry that furloughs people. They just say, hey, hasta la vista, and they bring somebody else in later anyway.
All right, let's push ahead, shift gears, and talk about China. Aviation in China. Here's what we know. Here's what I think we know. You guys can jump in and correct me if you think otherwise. But I think...
Will you be speaking in English or in Mandarin?
My Mandarin, I know a little bit of Mandarin, but not enough to carry this conversation, that's for sure, Rob. So, military aviation, it's advancing with fighters and UAVs, but the Chinese lack some key technologies that they really desperately want to acquire, like engine technology, for example. Commercial aviation, this is a giant emerging market, but it's difficult. The indigenous Chinese ARJ-21 regional jet, that's floundered. And the Comac C919 airliner, that's not coming along quite as it needs to. And actually, I just read recently, Richard Abalafia has got a great commentary on this in the September 3rd, 2013 issue of Aviation Week, if you're interested in more on that. And in fact, we had a listener, Dan Simmons, sent us a link to a BBC piece that was titled Chinese Air Fleets to Triple in Size. And this is referring to the latest Boeing 20-year forecast. So there's a lot of growth projected there. All right, that brings us to general aviation. So we know the Chinese want to build that industry. But here again, they lack some key knowledge. And they don't have the infrastructure, certainly, that you'd need to massively grow general aviation in China. So we have an article in China Daily, and it's titled Future of Commuter Aviation Expected to Take Flight Soon. And it's an interesting article. It describes the benefits that general aviation can provide, like means of transportation for business travelers. What they say is that the George Heinz Aircraft Manufacturing Company is building two aircraft, the CH-801HD and the CH-750HD. Now, both of these have made maiden flights. They're, you know, kind of smallish general aviation aircraft, short takeoff and land. They can take off and land on a 60-meter runway. And this manufacturer has signed, this other manufacturer has signed an 800 million yuan, which is roughly $130 million contract to produce 300 of these small airplanes over the next 5 years. And they want to establish some... Now, they call them mini airports in a number of different locations, like a couple hundred of them, that folks can use for short-distance flight with these airplanes. It's kind of an interesting thing to watch because it's like, how do you create a general aviation infrastructure and market and manufacturing capability kind of from nothing? It's almost like starting with a clean sheet of paper. I don't know if that's a great idea or a tough.
You're right, Max. They are creating this from zero, ground zero, and this almost sounds to me like one of those adverts from or a story you might have read in Popular Science in the 1950s here in the United States. An airplane in every driveway, and people will just use them, kind of the way they use bicycles today, and zip off to here and zip off to there, and I think what that tells you is that. The person that wrote this article really does not understand the infrastructure that's necessary to make a network like that come alive. And I mean, it's not just about building airplanes. Although you said 60-meter runways, I mean that's pretty short. I mean
that is short.
Yeah, that's under 400 feet. So I don't know how many people, I forgot what it said, these things are going to carry, but there's a lot more to it than simply building the airplanes and talking about lots of short runways. The airspace is still not very open although they had planned on it being, but, you know, it's still all controlled by the Chinese military. And so I kind of have think you have to take this one with a grain of salt.
But, okay, so what comes first, the airplanes or the airports?
I think airports. I mean, what good is an airplane if you can't use it anywhere?
Well, I mean, there are things called grass strips.
Possibly, but I don't see those as being reliable locations to conduct the kind of things that the kind of business day to day that this writer was talking about in this article.
It almost sounded, or almost read, like it was written by a bureaucrat.
Well, of course it was. It's Chinese press. I guess it's the chicken and the egg. I mean, what comes first, the airports or the airplanes? I know you have to have an airport for the airplane to fly out of after it's built. Why would they go to all the trouble of building up the airplanes if they're not going to build the infrastructure to support them?
Well, I didn't say that they're not going to build it. What I meant is I think that it's a much more complex process than they make it sound like. And I think having a network of airports in the right place in order to support all these little commuter airplanes they're talking about, I don't think they understand the complexity of the problem. And multiply that by how many, let's see, how large is China? It's the size of North America or something? I should know that. My geography is not very good.
The geography of China is much different than, say, here in the United States. You know, we have the whole central of the country, which is basically flat. There's very little flat in China. So, I mean, that's going to even more complicate the infrastructure.
I agree. And so, again, show me one city. Show me one city with a network where someone has put in paved runways of say 500 or 600 feet to be able to take these airplanes in six or eight locations around a major city, and I'll believe it. I don't think, from what I read, there was any talk about the airports other than the fact that the runways only needed to be 300 meters. And so, again, I just think it's going to be a little more complicated.
See, he can't even on the 60-meter airports that they were talking about, he upped it to 300 meters.
Oh, is that what it was? 60 meters? Okay, I can't remember.
60 meters, yeah.
See, this is the problem with getting old. I barely can remember your names, guys. no, seriously. And look at how we've tried something similar here in the States over the years. And we've had an infrastructure in place for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years of local airports, and it's tough. But maybe, you know, maybe they can reinvent the wheel. I don't know. I'm just a little skeptical.
Yeah, maybe it'll come down to whether this is driven sort of as what we in the West would kind of, you know, think of as a commercial operation versus something that's government created and driven, you know, over there. I mean, it's partly the same. I think you mentioned it a little bit earlier, Rob. It's partly the same problem they're having with their other aircraft, you know, ventures, in that it's too much of a bureaucratic government operation, and that doesn't work so well in some cases. And establishing aviation as an industry is, I think, one of them. So let's move on to our next topic. This is about air shows, and this is an article in the AOPA news. It's called "Can Air Shows Come Back?" They point out that 2013 was really a tough year for air shows in the U.S. They mentioned the unfortunate accident that killed Jane Weicker, the wing walker, and her pilot, Charlie Schwenker, and that was captured on film and played over and over and over in the news, and kind of didn't help form people's opinions about what happens at air shows. And then, of course, we had this sequestration activity going on, which is the U.S. budget austerity measure that we call sequestration here. And that grounded the military demonstration aircraft. I mean, David, that pretty much grounded every bit of the military demonstration teams, didn't it?
Military demonstrations include things like flyovers at baseball games and football games and flyovers over military funerals, as well as the Thunderbirds, the Blue Angels, the Golden Knights, and the Jet teams, the F-18, the two F-18 teams, and the A-10 team and the F-16 team. All of that was just stopped. The Air Force says, we can't fly regular squadrons. We're not going to fly these. But for every one of those jet teams, being just if we talk about the biggest, which is the Blues and the Thunderbirds, quite a few shows basically canceled once they found out they weren't getting the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels. Now, all of the military bases who were scheduled to have performances or open houses, they stopped. But the bottom line is it basically reduced the income of the airshow industry by about one half this year.
Wow. I mean, so that's a huge economic impact. And then, of course, there's the, you know, the, I don't know, the goodwill or the publicity that the military demonstration teams bring to folks who watch them. And I think we've said this before. I mean, a lot of there's this stereotypical, you know, little kid who's watching the Blue Angels or that kind of a demonstration team and sits there and says, I want to do that. And that sparks that interest in aviation as a career. So we've lost that for this year anyway.
And while promises are being made, we know that promises can be taken away very quickly. The other really important thing, and I'll let the expert on Air Venture talk about this, was the FAA announced that not only EAA next year, but everybody is going to be charged for air traffic controllers. They want, you want an air show, you're going to pay the FAA to for the privilege of having it.
Yeah, and you know, it was tough enough for the EAA to come up with the $450,000 that they had to pay to the FAA. And of course, that's being contested. Brent, you probably have some awareness of this. The EAA is taking the FAA to court over this issue, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, and I feel like the whole thing is a little bit of dirty pool. I mean, the sequestration thing happened so rapidly that the airshow industry last year, I mean, it couldn't really respond. I mean, Air Venture did a pretty good job of patching their lineup, you know, from a performer standpoint. I think they did a pretty good job of mixing it up and going kind of grassroots and trying to fill that void. And I think that's what other air shows will see them do next year, you know, the ones that have, you know, now they have a chance to know what the playing field's going to look like. But this whole air traffic control thing, that is the camel, in my opinion, is the camel getting its head in the tent on the whole user fee thing, in my opinion. I mean, something we really got to get a hold. This is a service they're providing as part of the taxes that we pay, and I just don't feel like it's fair that they can just spring that on, you know, a big organization like that just because they have the money to fund it. Doesn't mean that it was the right call by any stretch.
And I think that's why they're taking them to court. To force FAA to prove how it managed to come up with this whole silliness. And as you said, we've been paying fees through fuel taxes for years, and that's what supports the Airport and Airway Trust Fund and most of the money that comes to operate the FAA essentially comes from there. And so, again, to make this last minute, it would have been one thing, I think, if they had said, come October, things are going to change. You know, if they'd said that maybe last spring, the industry would have been upset, but at least they'd have had some time to react. And but this one of, oh, did we tell you guys that by now you're going to have to pay all your traffic control? Got to go. Just put that check in the mail. Bye. You know, and that's essentially how it all came down. And that's the really frightening part, which is why I think EAA had those big buttons up there everywhere at Air Venture this year that say it ain't over. so we'll see how it goes down.
Presumably, well, I don't know. I don't know what the grounds for the suit are. I mean, I don't know the specifics. So that if the EAA prevails, is that also going to affect the other air shows that are, you know, kind of teed up for next year to pay their own way as well?
You know, we should get Jack Pelton back on here. We had him on here a couple of months ago, and just as this whole thing was starting, and that's probably a great a great topic to ask. You know, and again, as you said, if they win, what precedent does that set?
Right. Exactly. Because sometimes these suits, you know, are decided around, you know, a very specific legal issue that may apply to that particular situation, but may not apply at all to other situations, other air shows. And so it may not set a precedent for them. We don't know. You have to know what the issues are, the legal issues that are being contested. So, yeah, we should find that out.
And I think we should follow up once December comes along and the International Council of Air Shows, ICAS, has their meeting in Las Vegas to talk about the following air shows and who's going to be where and stuff. And we'll see if the air show industry starts coming along, not just EAA, but the rest of the air show industry, about this topic.
Yeah, very good. Okay, moving on. AIN Online, Flight Options Parent Buys FlexJet. Okay, so now listen up, because we're going to have a quiz at the end of this. So Ken Rickey is head of Directional Aviation Capital, and they own Flight Options, Sentient Air, Nextant Aerospace, and Constant Aviation, as well as a bunch of other companies. Now, they're buying the fractional provider FlexJet from Bombardier for $185 million. So, Rob, and maybe Brent, too, first, can you help us understand who all these companies are? What do they do?
It is interesting in the precept that, you know, the mergers and acquisitions aren't just for the big boys. So it's starting to permeate different parts of the industry. So,
oh no, that's a good point. In fact, that's exactly the point I was going to make, Brent. It is just that. I mean, we've had these fractionals for a while. A couple of them have kind of disappeared lately. Advance Air, of course, is in bankruptcy. And the beach, I forgot what they called the beach provider.
Travel Air,
right, before Flight Options bought them years and years ago. And, of course, NetJets is still around. But the other big player was FlexJet. And now they're going to be gone too. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. They said they're going to run them as a separate operation, but keep the name, and they're going to be the high-end fractional. But the point is that it's going to be one company kind of controlling a huge portion of the market. In fact, I wonder, I haven't heard anything from the DOJ about the concerns over Flight Options controlling too much of the fractional market.
I think they get to weigh in on this.
I'm sure they do. But I bet you that nobody probably cares.
So just for folks who may not be aware, can you describe sort of the business model for a company like FlexJet? How does that work?
Sure. I mean, essentially, someone will decide they either don't want to spend the money or don't want to go through the work of having their own flight department for their company, say, one airplane to take the boss and the various other employees around the country to wherever they need to be. So they will go after a fractional provider, which says, look, we'll do all the legwork for you, and all the scheduling, all the maintenance. We'll take care of all the pilots and the flight attendants if they're needed, and you don't worry about anything. You just pay us a flat fee every month and so much per hour for every hour that you or your people are in the airplane. And for that, they don't get immediate attention when they want an airplane somewhere, but that's really the network of these fractionals is how they manage to make sure that they keep everybody happy and that an owner can get an airplane within a certain number of hours to whatever location they're at that will take them to wherever it is they want to go. And then once the airplane's gone, they don't worry about it anymore. They just wait and they call it. Essentially, it's like calling a taxi when you're done with whatever you're doing, and you go on to the next time. But again, you don't have all the overhead and all the muss and fuss of operating a flight department. And those can be interesting, as our guest, I'm sure, will understand.
Yep.
So, Brent, is part of the idea that a company like a NetJets or someone like that can offer sort of efficiencies of scale and things that a corporate flight department would have difficulty matching? Is that kind of what we look at here?
Yeah, you know, I mean, just in generalities, I mean, your corporate flight departments, you know, I worked at a corporate flight department before my current gig, and you know, the airplanes have a lot of idle time. And so I think part of what the fractional model is trying to do is capitalize on that asset that's just sitting around and sort of share it. And it's not unlike shared ownership a little bit in that regard, but it just does better. It does a better job of utilizing the asset.
The big guys like NetJets, I mean, they have quite significant size fleets, I would imagine. And we see that there's an order, a large order associated with this deal, or at least happening at about the same time where they're looking to buy 85 business jets, $1.8 billion. It's some Learjets, some Challenger 350s, Challenger 605s, and then options for 160 more airplanes worth another $3.4 billion. So this is a lot of airplanes. This represents a lot of business for Bombardier. And I don't know if this whole selling NetJets is, I don't know how closely wrapped up in this aircraft deal this is, but there's probably some kind of relationship.
I think the word you have to use is very wrapped up, because you notice that the only airplanes they're buying are for Bombardier, and that's what Flexjet has traditionally operated. So again, it might have been time for Bombardier to focus on other issues. I mean, as we all know, they have the C series that they're trying to get up and running, and they may have just said, you know what, this is not really our core business. There's an opportunity here to get out from under it. Let's do it, sell them some airplanes, and that is what we do.
All right, one final item, and this came in from listener Jamie. This is kind of a different sort of an item, but it's maybe worth just touching on really quickly. And this is about some malware that's called, I guess, PsykiPot. Is that how you pronounce this? I don't even know. PsykiPot. So it's malware, and what we have is a report from Trend Micro, which is a computer security company. And they've reported that this particular malware program is being directed at the U.S. civilian aviation sector, mostly through email messages. Now, this kind of malware, it's been around for years. And this one in particular, or variants of it since 2007, generally targeting defense companies. And it's oftentimes attributed to China, back to this issue of the Chinese desperately looking for some technology. And apparently, it's as Trend Micro says, it's being directed towards the commercial, the civilian aviation sector. This is a kind of malware, I think you usually call this spear phishing, which is sort of a social engineering kind of an approach. Basically, you can get an email that looks legitimate. It may look like it's from your own company, or it may look like it's from your customer, or the government, or somebody that has every appearance of being legitimate, and in there somewhere is something that you need to click, and then once you do that, then you've activated the malware. You know, this is, having worked for 35 years for a large defense contractor, this is the kind of thing that we pay a lot of attention to. So maybe the takeaway from this is that, as always, but particularly with respect to this, be careful about what you get in your email. And don't assume that just because something might look legitimate that it necessarily is. You need to be very suspicious.
Have we heard anything about but what the malware is actually doing once it affects or infects someone's computer?
Not that I've seen, but typically, you know, what this does is it gives somebody or a remote server, let's say, access into your network that you wouldn't otherwise. So whereas your corporate firewall might prevent access from outside parties trying to hack in, if you can get inside the firewall, like via an email, and get somebody inside the firewall to click on something and execute a program, that it can create a kind of a passageway, if you will, inside that firewall, and then they can run around and look for interesting things to take data and so forth. So, it's something to be very careful of.
So would a piece of malware like this be something we could use to turn everybody's browser default into theairplanegeeks.com?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, that would be terrible. I'm sorry. I'm just...
Of course. Well, just the other day, you know, I received an email that looked everything like it came from Apple Computer, saying that someone had tried to log into my Apple account, my iTunes account, from another country. And that was suspicious, so my account was being temporarily suspended. And then to reactivate my account, I just had to click this link, and it would take me to where I could do that. Well, the whole thing is phony. It's made to look like it's from Apple. It was not. So that's an example of this kind of spear phishing, they call it, that you have to watch out for.
Sneaky.
Sneaky, sneaky. All right, again, we're speaking with Brent Owens. He writes fixedwingbuddha.com and also the iFlyBlog.com. Brent, which of those came first? Where did you start with your blogging?
Well, I started about a year ago with iFlyBlog, and really just as a outlet. I kind of figured that I had a lot to say and had some experience in, you know, in general aviation, and a good friend of mine actually put me up to it that is in the industry. He's actually a reporter, and so he goes, "Hey, you should start a blog, and you know, you've got a lot of, you know, interesting things to say." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, you know." So a year later, I'm still doing it, and I really enjoy it. I think that's kind of my creative outlet, and not that I'm any good at it, but I really, really have a fun time just exploring new thoughts and new ideas. And so I fly blog is really just it's really just generic. I mean, any kind of sort of random thing that comes my way that I want to talk about, I just put it on there. And so it's fun. It's entertaining, and it's, you know, somewhat educational. There's things on there about, you know, just, you know, all kinds of topics. And it's just kind of stuff that I want to talk about. But the other website a couple months ago is much more focused. One of the themes that, you know, I've discovered, and you guys are all, you know, more than apprised of this whole, you know, catastrophic problem we're having with general aviation and the cost involved. So I really wanted to just create a site that was focused just on that theme. So it wasn't sort of hidden in there, you know, and you had to go digging for it. It was this whole website that's its sort of sole purpose is sort of to try to advertise ways to, you know, save money in your a new guy and you've never even seen an airplane before, or you're in training, or you're post training and you're a renter, or maybe you're looking at ownership or even build an airplane, because I have experience in that, and so I added a section for that. And it really those four major themes are represented, and just to make it a sort of a centralized place for that kind of thing. And a lot of the ideas aren't new. Many of these best practices have been out there for a long time, figuring out how to do this without breaking the bank. But put them all in one place, and then I obviously give it my, you know, my sort of angle on it and everything. And that's really what mostly that website's all about. I also kind of have a sort of a philosophical bent that's in there as well, and that's sort of where the Buddha came in the name. But the kind of the idea of the altruism in aviation, what I wanted to do with that was to try to tell as many stories as I could find about, you know, people that were just doing really neat things in flying that was in sort of a giving mode. So like you talked about Angel Flight, that's an obvious great example of that. And so that, you know, those kinds of things, I like to put those, I sprinkle those in there, you know, just because that's just, you know, just the way I wanted to come at it.
Do you have some examples of some of those things?
Yeah, you know, like, one example was there's an article in there about Nancy Warren. She actually gave a cardinal, and she's 84 years old, or years young, I should say, and she gave her cardinal to two young men that she had befriended, you know, a couple years prior to this and was flying around with, and she just gave them the airplane.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing, you know, things like that. And, you know, even some simple stories. I've got one story in there about a good friend of mine, and he is religious about never flying by himself. He always drags someone to the airport with him, and generally they're not pilots, you know, so he's really trying to be this advocate. I mean, he flies young eagles and he does that sort of traditional, you know, thing, but he also has this other, you know, he's really, really good about it. And I think everybody can kind of learn lessons from that. And so those kind of things. And then sort of the other part of that also is to have some inspirational nuggets in there as well, you know, to tell, you know, stories that, you know, that might, you know, help a person, you know, be inspired by, you know, don't give up on your dreams and that kind of thing. So those are all just part of it. But the main theme is really about saving cash. I mean, make no mistake, that's the primary, you know, vehicle for that website. But, yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's only been a couple months since I started it, and I've collected a lot of great ideas from folks that have stopped by and from the other blog and just from friends and people in the know and obviously other, you know, AOPA and some of the other big alphabet groups. They do a nice job on, you know, like shared ownership. You know, AOPA has a lot of information about that, but you kind of got to go digging for it in some regard, because it's mixed in with the safety stuff and the learn to fly stuff and how not to shoot an approach or whatever. And so this is just that's all that's on there. You're not going to learn about how to shoot an ADF approach on this website.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I think that the cost of learning to fly and getting your license is something that really really restricts the number of people who try to do that. I mean, is there hope? Is there a way to get your license without you know, mortgaging your home if you even have a home?
Well, yeah, and, you know, and this is one of the ways I kind of came to this website. To be honest, it's a personal story. I was at Oshkosh. This was 3 or 4 years ago, and I was with my brother-in-law, and we're walking around the LSA mall, and he's just marveling over, you know, the. And I'm probably mispronouncing the name. Sinus? Is that how you pronounce it? I don't know. It's Australia. I think it's Austrian or whatever company that makes Light Sport and very, you know, nice airplanes, really high end. And, you know, he's just oogling over this one particular model that they had there. And, you know, it's like 125K. And my brother-in-law had never, he's not a pilot. He's never flown, any of that kind of stuff. And he's thinking, boy, you know, maybe I could, you know, figure out maybe I can sell part of my farm and get this, you know, somehow get this, you know, $125,000 airplane. I had to stop him and say, look, I mean, that's awesome and that's great, but you don't have to buy that to be a pilot. You know, there's a whole other track you could go down. And I think the problem that we run into as an industry, and it's probably true in every industry, but the shiny object effect that goes on, you know, Cirrus, and not to beat up on them because they're great airplanes, but you know, the new you know, Diamonds and things like that, they're not cheap, and they're the ones, they're the glossy, you know, pages in the magazines. They get all the press on the websites, you know, and that kind of thing, and they're sort of prominent, and so that kind of gives the newbie the impression that, you know, boy, this is a yacht, you know, this is the price of a yacht kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think what gets missed in there is there's other methods to go about this. And I was really lucky to grow up under a guy who, and I grew up in Oklahoma, you'd have to know a little bit about my background, but the fellow that mentored me, I mean, he was oil field guy, you know, I mean, he's, you know, kind of a crude individual in terms of, you know, get her done type stuff. But I mean, he introduced me to a whole world of flying that you can do without, you know, I mean, without spending, you know, massive amount of money. I mean, he would drag home a Volks plane, if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, like I remember those.
Yeah, he'd drag home one of those from an auction. You know, he paid $3,000 for it, and we fly it around for 2 years, you know, just having a ball and on no money. I mean, just literally just no money. And I just don't think that people think in those terms. Now, I mean, obviously you need to have someone that can help you out with that, because you're not going to walk out to your local flight school and say, hey, I want to buy a, you know, Volks plane and learn to fly in it. That's not practical. But certainly, you know, Jim, my mentor, I mean, he introduced a lot of people by, you know, let's go find yourself a clapped out 150 and learn, you know, we'll teach you to fly it and, you know, that kind of thing. And he grew a business out of a town of 25,000 people. And we flew 1,000 hours a year just in students. And I mean, we had a really good business down there, and it was all because he was creative, and he promoted, you know, well, he was a good people person. You know, that's just part of it. And I think if we were able to, and that's part of what I'd like the website to do, would be to try to share sort of a little bit different worldview when it comes to flying airplanes than what they would see in, you know, in XYZ magazine on the bookshelf or whatever.
So do you build your own as a way to save money, or do you build your own for other reasons?
Well, that's an interesting philosophical conversation. And on the surface, you can obviously save money by doing it, at least in my opinion. The RV, like my RV-8 is an example. I wouldn't even be able to go buy that airplane. You know, there's nothing out there that you can buy that's an RV-8. I mean, you could probably make some comparables and, you know, well, maybe I'll go get an extra, you know, it's a off-the-shelf airplane or something. But an extra is really a whole different mission, does what it does much better than an RV-8. And, you know, so it's really apples and oranges. So there's a whole plethora of airplanes out there that you can't even buy. You'd have to build them if you wanted them. And so that's a whole other part of the philosophy. The financial part certainly comes into play in terms of how you could pay for a home built. And I'll use myself as an example. I'll just give you the raw, honest numbers here. I spent $30,000 of my own money. I borrowed $50,000 from a lender that lends money to people who build airplanes. It's amazing. And you know, I've got $80,000 leveraged, and the airplane's worth $100,000, and I'm a happy guy. If I need to sell it tomorrow and liquidate, you know, the asset, I can do that and not be, you know, I'm protected. Obviously, to finish an airplane, to do what it takes to, you know, see it through, you need to enjoy the building process to some extent. If you go in with your only goal is just to save money, you're probably going to have a hard time finishing it. It takes a lot of tenacity to do it. And, you know, I know a lot of friends that have started projects, sold them. You know, there's just, you can look in TradePoint any given day and see the ads for partially completed airplanes. But it is a great way to save money if you're already a tinkerer and you like that kind of thing and you up for the experience of it. I don't think it's overly hard. I think it's just a matter of digging deep and asking a lot of questions and doing a lot of research and being humble. And I think virtually anybody can build an airplane. Jim's the guy, I'll refer to him again, Jim Brewer, my mentor, his mother-in-law, and she was in her 60s. She built, I think, the second Pulsar kit to fly.
You're kidding. Wow.
No, and she did it all herself. I mean, Jim, you know, would basically provide a tech counselor assistance, but that was about it. I mean, she did it all. I mean, I think a lot of people kind of, you know, everybody that I talked to about my airplane, they go, oh, I could never do that. You know, I could never do that. And I think they would be surprised. I have another story. A good friend of mine flies an RV-4, literally had never drilled a hole in anything before he started his kit. And obviously he drilled 15,000 holes. That's about how many rivets are in an RV-4. You know, so it can be, and it's beautiful. I mean, he's got a great airplane, flies wonderfully. He's got over 1,000 hours on it. But, you know, so I think a lot of people kind of come from this place of lack when it comes to that. And so it kind of colors their vision of what they can and can't do. But at the end of the day, it's certainly feasible. But I think your question is valid. If all you're looking forward to do is save money by doing it, you're probably going to have a, you know, hard time getting it through to completion. Because you're probably going to get frustrated and, you know, 2 years into it, you quit.
So you can save money by building it, but you've got to have sort of the passion for doing the build.
That's correct. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Not to mention rushing. I mean, and that would be another liability if you were building your own airplane and you only wanted it because as soon as you had finished it, you could go out and fly and save money. You might, maybe not intentionally, but, you know, possibly skip a few things here and there. And you're not building a hot rod that, you know, if something comes loose, you pull over to the side and kick the tire and go, oh, you stupid car. I mean, you're talking about your life here, and, you know, you have to be pretty careful. But I just wanted to comment on your earlier point about finding used airplanes. There are a lot of used airplanes out there that still have an awful lot of good life left in them. So, you know, there are ways to learn to fly that are not as expensive as what you might hear if you only go to the local flight school. But let's be serious, too. We've kind of, in the last decade, we've kind of spoiled people. I mean, they see the inside of a Cirrus with all those whistles and bells and glass panels and multifunction displays and PFDs and it goes on and on and on. And they don't want an old 150 that maybe only has, an airspeed indicator and a and a tack and an oil pressure gauge, and they're a little spoiled sometimes. I'm not saying everybody is, but I think that's something we can't minimize.
No, Rob, I think your point is completely valid. I have a good friend of mine, and he is fully rated. You know, he doesn't fly for a living or anything, just for recreation. But he's got all of his certificates, and he doesn't fly almost expressly for that reason, because what he wants to fly, he can't afford it, so he just doesn't fly at all.
Hmm. I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Get spoiled.
Yeah. I mean, so I can see it. Part of what I've done, some of the things I've talked about on the website is, you know, maybe setting expectations. You know, if a person can't afford to fly, you know, and go out and get their private, well, let's back up to LSA. And if you can't do LSA, let's back up to something else. You know what I mean? I got one friend that flies hang gliders, you know, and eventually I think he'll go fixed wing and get his stuff. But this is what he's doing right now. And at least he's flying. You know what I mean? At least he's flying.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
And I think you have to ask yourself, why are you doing it? Are you doing this because you really want to learn to fly, because you can't imagine not becoming a pilot at some point in your life, or is there something else going on? And sometimes when you look at the motivations, that can give you a few different answers as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Brent, do you get much feedback or questions from folks, or is it too kind of early on in that you've only had the blog going for a couple of months?
Yeah, I get a little bit, but yeah, it's still pretty young. I get a lot more feedback off of my other website, just because there's a lot larger audience there. But yeah, it's growing. Every day it gets a few more visitors, and I get a few comments and emails offline on it, and asking questions and stuff. And I'm very, very open to that. If someone comments on there, they can expect to hear back from me probably within hours if I'm not up flying or doing something else, because I really want to hear what people have to say. And if someone has a question, I would love to be able to try to help them. Or if someone's got experience in an area that, you know, where they're like, you know, they know something that would be really helpful to the folks that come there, boy, I want to get that, you know, that's like gold. So it's been a lot of fun. I'm actually writing an ebook to kind of go with the website.
Oh.
So that way, if folks want to, get to grab the ebook, they won't really have to. If they want to, they can just get all the stuff for free off the website. So it's not like, it's not like something they would have to get or whatever. But that's just a little pet project, kind of my first, stab at authoring. But it's really not even a book; it's more of a guide. So I wouldn't really call it too much of a publishing effort. But it's something I'm working on, and the whole thing is really just I really am worried about this whole regression that we're going through, with the pilot population. You know, part of me, a good friend of mine wrote an article recently about, how unfriendly FBOs can be. And I know you guys have talked about that in the past, as well as a lot of other folks too, the 12-foot chain link fence. And then you go in and it's the grumpy guy at the coffee machine or whatever. And, so I don't think we put the best face on aviation. And I don't know. I was writing something last night on this. I haven't published it yet. It almost seems like our demographic, in some regard, is hurtful. You know, we're a personality people. We're very, some people are kind of introverted, and not everybody. I mean, you guys are obviously promoting aviation, doing the good work, but I think there's a lot of people out there that don't exactly put the best face on aviation. And when you couple that up with all the other barriers to entry, it's just like, whoa, boy. $6, $7 a gallon gas, and it's really getting tough. So.
Yeah, it's up. Yeah, and it gets discouraging for people who might otherwise be interested.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you get someone that's on the fence, and it's just like, I think I would just go buy a bass boat. You know, I'm good. So, I guess the whole tragedy of it is because you guys and I know, how wonderful this thing can be, and how much fun it can be, and how rewarding it is, and you just love to see it proliferate versus, going the other direction. And I know from an industry standpoint, we're talking about United and their recalls. I mean, I think the pilot shortage is looming. And I heard that back 30 years ago when I started, and we heard it a couple more times in the meantime. But I think this one's this is the big one. I think it's going to really happen maybe this time. Maybe not, but I my sense of it is that we're going to need every hand on deck in 10 years.
Well, and I think one of the reasons that, that I believe this is going to be worse this time than in the past is that everybody at the high end, the airlines, the airports, even some of the not associations like AOPA necessarily, but some of the other ones, all will tell you, yeah, you know, you're right. That's a real problem. And you know, unwritten in parentheses is, boy, I hope somebody solves that, because, I mean, I know it's not my problem. But there's right, not going to be any industry. There won't be any fixed base operators. There won't be any maintenance repair organizations. A lot of things are going to cease to be when the end of the pipeline that provides people to drive the airplanes dries up. And despite the fact that my two co-hosts are, you know, co-hosting their UAV Digest, and David for sure knows that there's not going to be pilots much longer anyway. Right, David? I just, you know, it's crazy because...
Stop. I resent that remark.
I just...
You know, no.
Oh, here we go.
You don't throw that out there. I have never said there won't be pilots, because there will always be people who love to get in an airplane by themselves and look at the clear blue sky, something that I don't have the privilege of doing. I've never, ever said there won't be pilots.
Well, no, that's true. But I mean, and Brent, imagine if you've got a load of... how often do you get to fly?
Oh, I fly at least once a week.
Once a week. Okay. So can you imagine any of your passengers saying, yeah, we'd get on the airplane if there was only one of you? Oh, yeah, right. They wouldn't even want to do it with one. But no, none? No. I just...
And how many commuter flights do that, Rob?
With one person?
How many commuter flights down in the islands do it with one pilot?
Yeah, they don't go over 1,000 feet above the water. And the longest trip is, you know, 40 miles. I mean, it's a little different when you're in a jet up high and long distances.
Is it?
Oh, I...
Is it?
Yeah. The flying's more complex. The trip planning and the weather and everything else. I mean, look at the guys down in the islands. They don't fly when the weather's bad. I mean, they just go, oh, no, man, you know, we wait an hour and then we come back, you know, man, no big deal. No worries. You know, I mean, it's not quite like that every place else. But I guess I'm just trying to make the point that I agree with Brett, that I think that it's going to come. It really is. And I think we're already starting to see it. Because we're focusing on it, but mm-hmm. even the regionals are running out of people. They're just you can't get people to work for those wages when they have the debt that they have. That wasn't the problem, you know, when I started that stuff 30 years ago.
I had $25,000 invested in my stuff. You know, it was it was no big deal. Now those numbers have quadrupled easily.
Oh yeah, and look at the new reg we were talking about that couple of weeks ago, guys. I mean, if you were a brand new kid coming out of Embry-Riddle right now, and you had a 4-year degree, and you had 250, maybe 300 hours of flight time, in the old days, 5, 6, 8 years ago, you could have probably, if you were lucky, you could have probably gotten an interview somewhere at some regional airline. But that's not going to happen anymore.
That will definitely slow the pipeline down.
Yeah, and there's just not enough traffic out there of people learning to fly to keep all of these flight instructors busy to try to build time to get them to the point where they can get into the right seat. So there's a disconnect coming. It hasn't quite hit yet, but it's coming.
Yeah, and you know, in the general aviation world, I mean, I think, and this has been said before, this is not my concept, but it makes complete sense to me, in that if you want to know what general aviation is going to look like in the United States, you just need to look across the pond to see what it's like over there now. You know, where they have fuel prices that are, you know, astronomical, and they've user fees, and everybody has co-ownership or shared ownership to even be able to afford to have an airplane or their flying gliders. You know, it's. And I know it's a generalization because there's a lot of you know, healthy GA pockets in the UK and in Europe and stuff. But overall, I mean, we really have it good, and we stand to lose it if we rest on our laurels.
All right. Well, why don't we let that be the last word on that topic for now anyway. Brent, can you tell our listeners where they can find your blogs? And you're also on Twitter as well, I think.
Yeah, you can find the blogs. My kind of main clearinghouse blog is iFlyBlog.com. And then the money-saving tips blog is FixedWingBuddha.com. And that's all one word. And I'm on Twitter at iFlyBlog. And I have a Facebook page too under the same name. So, but yeah, I'm out there. So if anybody wants to get in touch with me, love to talk to you or Twitter you or whatever.
Very good. So Brent, you going to be able to stick with us for the rest of the show?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, that's terrific.
Hey, I was going to mention that I flew a 233, but I never got to fly a 232 in reference to the airplane you're about to talk about.
Ah, really? All right. Well, let's listen to the airplane. David, you know, sometimes I call this the aircraft of the week. Sometimes I call it the airplane of the week. I think I better just start calling it the aircraft of the week. So now here's David Vanderhoof, our official airplane geeks historian, with the aircraft of the week.
Thanks, Max. Well, the airplane, I call it the airplane of the week. Now you got me all confused.
No, I tripped you up. Sorry. Sorry.
The airplane geeks airplane of the week, the Schweitzer SGS-232. A shout out to Errol Cavett and Randy DePasquale, who asked for a glider and an X-plane. Yeah, how am I going to pull that one off? Also, another post to answer the consistent cries of, we need more GA in the history segment. So, three brothers, Paul, William, and Ernest, started building their first glider in 1930. The first two gliders the brothers built was in their father's barn. With the help of a local attorney, Bob McDowell, the brothers moved to a second floor of the Elmira Knitting Mill Building. Thus, Schweitzer Aircraft was born and until 2004 was the oldest privately owned aircraft company in the United States, up until when Sikorsky Aircraft bought the corporation. During World War II, the SGS-28 and 212 were the training gliders of choice for the United States Army Air Corps. After the war, the SGS-123 was produced and became a record-setting competition glider. They also produced the 222, which became the most numerous training glider produced. Production ran from 1946 to 1967, totaling 258 handmade gliders. The SGS-232 was originally to be a small step up from the successful 222. However, market research of the marketplace became a high-performance sailplane with a greater wingspan than that of the 22. The design was finalized and production began in 1961. July 3, 1962, the aircraft took to the skies for the first time. The 232 has an aluminum semi-monocoque fuselage of 26 feet 9 inches or 8.15 meters. The wing, 57 feet 1 inch or 17.4 meters, with a total wing area of 180 square feet. Its gross weight is 1,080 pounds or 490 kilograms. It does not have flaps, but top and bottom dive brakes, a trademark of Schweitzer aircraft. The tail is an all-flying stabilator. The cockpit is a 2.5-seater. The front seat is a normal tub. The back seat is a bench capable of handling up to 2 150-pound small people. The ability to carry one passenger comfortably or two had made the aircraft popular among tourist operators. Up until the 232, most of the world's records for two-place gliders were held by less efficient gliders. Immediately, it became a record breaker of choice. Some of its records were Joe Lincoln and Chris Crowell flew a 232 named Cibola, a modified 232 with a 67-foot wingspan. The pair broke the world out-and-back flying record, flying 404 miles or 654 kilometers. Lincoln again would set the world two-piece speed record over a 100-kilometer or 63-mile triangular course at an average speed of 74 miles an hour. Babs Nutt, and I really not making that up, Babs Nutt set the world absolute record for a woman by flying her 232 to an altitude of 35,463 feet. The 232 also served with the United States military. The United States Air Force Academy has always provided glider training to its cadets. The 232 was known in the Air Force service as the TG-5. The United States Navy has used the 232 as the X-26 frigate. The original intent was to train test pilots on the condition of yaw-roll coupling. The proper term for yaw roll coupling is inertia coupling, which was discovered in high-speed jet flight. When an aircraft is rolled too quickly, it tends to pitch and yaw and can depart from controlled flight and then begins to tumble in all axes. Since a glider is slower, the pilot and instructor can pull the aircraft into an inertial coupling departure and then have the test pilot student learn how to recover the aircraft into controlled flight. In 1967, two X-26s were removed from the United States Naval Test Pilot School and modified to the QT-2 by Lockheed Corporation. The aircraft were given civilian registrations November 2471 Whiskey and November 2472 Whiskey. The QT-2, or QT for Quiet Thruster, were modified with a Continental I-200 engine and a V-belt reduction system and a four-bladed fixed prop. They were then sent to the Southeast Asia conflict and in 1968 used for tactical observation over the Ho Chi Minh Trail and used also during the Tet invasion. The two aircraft were then returned to the UNTPS and had their engines removed, making them X-26Bs. From the lessons learned, Lockheed created the Q-Star, or YO-3 Quiet Star. The aircraft was set to a United States Army requirement that an observation aircraft could not be heard on the ground while operating at 1,200 feet at night. Lockheed would build 11 of the YO-3s and were one of the first aircraft to use night vision goggles. It also had retractable landing gear. The YO-3 had an IO-360 engine driving a six-bladed fixed-blade prop. Nine of the 11 aircraft operated over Southeast Asia from 1970 to 1971. They were never shot down, nor did they ever take a round of gunfire. Two of the aircraft were given to the Louisiana Department of Fish and Game and were used for hunting poachers. Eventually, they were transferred to the FBI. NASA then acquired one and is used in rotorcraft research in 2009 was being used at Edwards Air Force Base. Five others are now on display at various museums throughout the United States. LTV, or Voigt, also used the 232 as the basis for their L-450 quiet recon aircraft using the same specs as the Q-Star. The difference was the power plant. In this case, it used engines that the ultimate engine, the Pratt Whitney PT-6A turboprop. Three aircraft were built and one crashed on its third flight. A second reached a height of 50,700 feet, the current world record for powered aircraft by a turboprop with a weight between 1,000 and 1,750 kilos. The third aircraft became part of the Compass Dwell program. First flown in October 1970, the XQ-93 was a UAV capable of carrying a payload of 700 pounds. They were to act as relay aircraft to replace the Lockheed EC-121 Constellation. In 1971, the United States Air Force canceled the Compass Dwell program with only two aircraft built. With 87 232s built and 7 X-27s built, there are currently 64 still flying. The United States Naval Test Pilot School still has two X-26B frigates, making it the longest-running X-plane program in United States history. So there you have it, a training GA aircraft, a competition glider, a stealthy observer, and the longest X program in history. Not bad for some brothers out of the back of a barn. So now off to All Horseheads, New York, to see if I can score a ride. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Oh, thanks, David. Boy, that's an amazing number of derivatives and uses for that thing.
You build a good airplane, you usually can find more uses of it.
Yeah. Now, Brent, you've flown?
Well, yeah, I flew the 233, which is kind of the ugly cousin to the 32, but not as high performance. But it's a pretty common glider trainer, and that's what I did all my glider training in. It's a fun airplane. Fun airplane. I liked it.
Oh.
It's nothing like the glass gliders of the modern age, but for its time, I mean, it's cheap. You can pick them up relatively inexpensive, and, you know, it's a hoot.
Rob, have you flown in a glider at all?
I've only been in a glider one time. And you know, good question. What's the difference between a glider and a sailplane?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I don't.
It might have something to do with running and jogging. You know, that's the age-old question. Yeah, so I don't know. I think the sore plane guy, I think that's the – I always thought that was the fast glass, you know. I don't know. I really don't – I wish – I don't know the technical difference there.
The difference between a sailplane and a glider is the lift provided by the wing. Gliders do not have as much lift as sailplanes. sailplanes have a further, I don't know what the technical term is, but the farther you go per feet of altitude loss, a sailplane has a higher ratio of that compared to a glider.
That makes sense.
Hmm. Interesting.
So my running and jogging thing was correct.
Yeah, it sounds that exactly. Way. Yeah, yeah, very good. Way to go, Brent.
You didn't just make that up, right, David?
Yeah, right.
No, actually, I didn't, because I actually looked it up at one point in my life.
Oh.
Because I'm obnoxious that way. I have to know the difference between a glider and a... Because what I think of a sailplane is I think of something like... I forget who the famous aerobatic person is that has a rocket-powered sailplane with the really long, tapered German tapered wings. A glider is a CG-4 that lands troops in D-Day. They're two different things.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Makes sense.
Now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by Jason Smart, author of Take Your Wings and Fly, A Journey Through a Private Pilot's License. Jason, welcome to Across the Pond.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, Jason, I'm really pleased to have you here. We always are excited by people who have gone through that journey, but there's lots of books on flying and learning to fly. Why did you write this one?
You know, you say there's actually lots of books on learning to fly, but actually there's not. Well, not like mine anyway. There's a lot of dry books I found when I was learning to fly, like technical manuals. And there wasn't really one, though, that I could find that was written from a personal viewpoint, someone who'd learned to fly in the UK.
Yeah.
There was a few blogs that you find on the internet and things, but nothing like a real sort of well-written book. So yeah. I thought I would. And I thought I'd put a bit of humor into my story as well.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the things that you do read are really dry. And also I found that they were written by people who seemed fearless. You know, they were like brave pilots all the time. They soloed in sort of 3 hours, spoke to air traffic control for 5 minutes. They always passed in the minimum amount of hours. Well, I wasn't like that at all. I wasn't coping very well in most of my training.
Yeah.
So that was one of the motivations. So I hope that my book offers a story of someone who wasn't as confident, wasn't always sure what was going on. I was like confused about this and that, especially at the start. So I wanted to read the reader to find out what it was really like to gain a PPL.
Yeah.
I know warts, the warts and all term is banded about a lot, but I think that my book actually genuinely offers that. For instance, you'll read about me do an altercation with one instructor, and that really, really shook my confidence at the time.
Yeah.
And you also read about me questioning whether I was actually capable of actually passing.
Well, Jason, let's just take a step back then. What was your motivation? Why did you want to become a pilot?
It started, I can pinpoint it exactly, it was when I was 10. My dad, he'd got a job in Australia, and obviously being in the UK involved a hefty plane journey. So I remember sitting, you know, as a passenger, as a 10-year-old boy, and then as we went down the runway, it was just, I thought, this is amazing. And then we got to Australia. I remember my dad bought me books and I would draw planes. And then we were only in Australia for a year. Then we came back and then it was Airfix models. I had 50, 60 of them dangling from my ceiling. But I remember at the time when I was, you know, a teenager thinking, well, I'll never be able to fly an aeroplane. You know, I thought it was only really, really intelligent, clever people or rich people that did it. And I never ever thought I did it. But so then in my 30s, I remember I became a teacher in the meantime. And in the UK, there's where I taught, it was one of the exit points of the local airport. So all the aircraft leaving that airport, that's the zone, would fly over my school. And I remember being outside up in the playground and looking up and thinking, you know what, maybe I should do it. Another teacher would say, you're always talking about planes, why don't you just do it?
Yeah.
And I thought, yep, I will.
Jason, I recognised from my training days many of the pitfalls and challenges of learning to fly in the book. What was your greatest hurdle?
Well, I had many hurdles, I've got to be honest. There wasn't just one. And the first one, I suppose, was my fear of heights. You know, I'm not joking. I can't stand on a ladder without feeling, you know, a bit wobbly and faint.
Yeah.
And people say to me, you know, how can you be scared of heights and be a pilot? But it's a different thing being inside, you know, being inside an enclosed cockpit. It's a totally different thing. So that was an issue at first. But another major issue was speaking on the radio. I really found that hard. I couldn't get to grips with it at first. Every time I pressed that button, my mind would just go into overload. It really bothered me. And I didn't think I'd be able to do it properly. I remember one time, and this is in the book, I was about to fly with a new instructor I'd not flown with before, and it was just before my first solo. And this new instructor, he obviously expected me to do all the radio work and be, you know, all fair with it, which I should have been by that point. Yeah. And I just couldn't do it. I remember I got some message from air traffic control, and I just didn't have a clue what to say back.
Yeah.
And then another time, I was flying solo by this time, you know, getting ready for my cross-country navigation type exercises. And I was just flying out. I was leaving the Leeds Bradford Airport zone, and the controller gave me, you know, frequency for the next controller. And I read it back, and he went negative. And he gave me it again, and I read it back, and he went negative. And he was getting more irate by the second, and I was hogging the frequency, saying the frequency back, and he was saying negative, and he was giving me the frequency, and all I was doing, I'd read out one digit wrong each time.
Yeah, we've all been there though, Jason, haven't we? And I think sometimes we're not honest enough to admit it.
That's the thing. You've got to realize when you learn to fly that everyone goes through this. It's just one of those things. And I can look back at it now and think, well, that was ridiculous. But I remember I was red in the cockpit. I was just embarrassed. And I was, oh, my goodness, what's happened there? So the radio. But I suppose my biggest hurdle, Alf, just one of confidence. I was especially nervous when flying by myself. Like, what if I got lost? What if I went into controlled airspace? What did I put new fuel in? What if I missed my call sign?
Yeah.
Half the time I was like a nervous wreck. But do you know what? Something amazing happened. So towards the about three quarters in through my training, I met another student who was about the same stage as me, and he was feeling exactly the same. He almost gave up because of lack of confidence, and he was just going through exactly the same emotional turmoil and thinking, why are we doing this? You know, it's meant to be a fun activity, and it's not. We're banging our heads against the wall because we just can't do it. And just talking to him, it really helped, and we realized, you know, actually, this is what everyone goes through. This is just a normal process of learning to fly, your self-doubts and the confidence issues, and it's just part of the deal.
So, Jason, what advice would you give to someone who's starting on the road to their private pilot's license?
Well, read my book, obviously. No, seriously. I'd say make sure you're prepared. It's not all aviator sunglasses and being, you know, worshipped by everybody. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. It's confidence sapping. And for anyone who's doing it in the UK, you're going to be a slave to the weather. You will be looking at the clouds every single day and wishing they weren't there. That's something you've got to get used to. And another thing, when I first started out, I thought, you know, 45 hours, I'll pass in 45 hours, no problem. I passed my driving test in the minimum amount of hours, so surely learning to fly would be the same. Yeah. Well, it isn't. 45 is the minimum. I did it in about 65. But then after that, it's when the fun begins. That student I was just talking about, the one who was the same as me and, you know, helped me get through the latter parts of my training, he passed at the same time as me. And we started flying together after we'd passed our PPLs. And it was just so much fun doing it with him. It really was. We flew all over England. We flew across the Irish Sea to the Isle of Man at one point. And it just really helped to fly with somebody else. And it was fun, and it was good fun. He's still a good friend of mine now. So my advice would be, study the books. Don't be concerned about the hours it takes to go solo. And don't worry about making mistakes. You will make them in every single lesson you do. And just try to enjoy it at the time. That's something I wish that I'd done. Just enjoyed the moment of learning to fly, because it was good fun.
Well, Jason, it's a really refreshing look on training. That, of course, is the book Take Your Wings and Fly. Where can we find out more about you and the book on the internet?
You could look on my website, which is theredquest.com, www.theredquest.com. And there you can find a Twitter link. But also you could check out my publisher's website. It's destinworld.co.uk, destinworld. And there's a whole bunch of aviation-related books on there. I'm just really grateful to Matt Falkis at Destined World for taking my book on. You know, I sent it out to a few different people thinking, is anyone going to look at it? And, you know, and he did, and he's the one who's got it out there. So, you know, great thanks to Matt Falkis of Destined World.
Yeah, well, we know Matt well. He's a great friend of the programme. Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for talking to me. Thank you very much.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond. Come on.
Thanks, Peter. Brent, when you first started flying, I know this was a long time ago because you started when you were pretty young, but did you start out with kind of full confidence, or was that something that you had to build as you went along?
Yeah, the fact that I was going to be a pilot was sort of never in question, but obviously my confidence sort of at the transactional level, if that makes sense, would be shaken from time to time as I was taking lessons, because I was, you know, 15, and you know, so certain things that, you know, and I had to, you know, I ended up having to stop for a while, and which didn't matter anyway because I wasn't old enough to even solo. Yeah, you know, I don't think I ever questioned I was going to be a pilot, but certainly at different points along the journey, my confidence would get shaken, and I'd be like, oh, can I do this thing that I'm trying to do? And like in that story there, I'm also afraid of heights. So I can relate.
That's yes. Interesting. So am I. I thought it was just me.
So, Rob, I'm curious, because you've probably instructed people at all different kinds of ages. Do you find any kind of correlation between age and confidence? I mean, are younger folks more likely to have more confidence, whereas older folks, it's sort of the opposite, or does it not matter?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I could give you one general statement. But what I could say is that when I've worked with younger people, they seem to be a little bit easier in terms of getting past a screw up. I mean, when they make a mistake, I go, hey, don't worry about it. It happens to all of us. They go, oh, okay. Whereas I have seen that not be the case with some people that are older, especially men. In general, yeah. I found women pilots are usually better pilots than the men are, because they don't get as hung up on their ego about so many of the things that they do.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and I would think that this kind of thing, I mean, not to stereotype people or genders or, you know, anything like that, but I would think that when you're in an environment like this, meaning you're up in an airplane and the consequences of messing up can be, you know, pretty disastrous, that it would really have an effect on how you viewed things, and, you know, different sorts of people would kind of react differently. All right. Well, listen, let's move on to the listener mail, and we'll see if we can get through as much of this as we can. First off, we heard from Launchpad Marzari again. We got it a little wrong last time. Marzari was at Tankosh for his last Pi rep, and now he sent in a little report from Hanaveda, which is a vintage airplanes event held every 2 years. He did mention that in 2011 at this event, the Messerschmitt Foundation had an ME-109 and an ME-262 fly in formation, but the 262 got some technical problems and wasn't there. But here's his report from the show.
Airplane geeks. This is Airplane Geek Reporter at Large, Launchpad Marzari, and this time we are at the old-timer Fliegentrafen at Hahnweg. What a good air show it's been. The key thing today that was just impressive was a five-ship formation flyover of JU-52s. Yes, five JU-52s in formation, five of them. Then they landed on the field and started taking on passengers for formation flying rides. Wow, what a fun time. The Red Bulls are here. They're P-38, they're Corsair, they're T-6s. There's also a couple of P-51s, some Yak fighters, and even a 1913 Bolero. Talk about a wispy aircraft. More to follow. Keep up the good work.
All right, thanks for that. So the JU-52, David, that's like a tri-motor.
If being a tri-motor is like a tri-motor, yes. The JU-52 3M, and I think 5 is the world's fleet. I didn't realize that we actually had that many operating. We were lucky last year at Oshkosh to have one, and it was the first time I actually had seen one fly, and one of my favorite airplanes, I'm sitting under one, hanging from the ceiling, so that would have been a very impressive formation, is five JU-52s.
And with great sounds, too, I'm sure. While we didn't have an Australia Desk report this time, we did get a voicemail from Grant McHaren on, well, maybe you could say his free market views of the so-called pilot shortage. That's in quotes. So Grant has a different take on this, guys. Take a listen to this.
Hey, guys, this is Grant, and I'm driving in Melbourne at the moment, and I thought I'd try out the Geeks line, 361, Geeks 01. Hey, regarding the pilot shortage and so on, if pilot salaries are not going up, there is no shortage, only posturing. Just remember that. If there's a shortage and there's a demand, the salaries will go up. Don't forget, if there's no salaries going up, then pilots are still just a bloody commodity. So watch that one. Once you see the salaries going up for all these positions, then you know that, yes, there is a shortage. Over here in Australia, I know a number of the leading mainline carriers weren't taking anyone without at least 500 hours, and they had to have multi, they had to have command, instrument, all this kind of stuff. Not little 250-hour ballywhacks. These were serious. You know, you had to really have shown your worth. You know what people did? They went out into the middle of nowhere, and they flew passengers with tourist operations. They went up north. They went and did heli mustering. They went and used aircraft to go and muster the stock. They went meat bombing and threw parachutists out the door. They towed banners. They did all this kind of stuff, and they worked for almost nothing to build their hours. And that was how you actually managed to get pilots up in time, and they got real experience. They got experience in commercial environments and in dodgy environments, very dodgy operators many times, but a lot of people were pretty cool and pretty good. And that's how young pilots always used to go and build their hours. Why can't people do that anymore? I know it costs a lot, but hey, you know, if the airlines want pilots and there's not a lot of pilots and the price has to go up, then suddenly if your salary is better than flipping burgers, then it starts to pay off going out and working for almost nothing to meat bomb or whatever it takes, fly passengers in the middle of nowhere to build your hours so that you can get that illustrious job with the airline, even a regional, etc. Anyhow, just my 2.5 cents worth once you adjust the South Pacific peso to the US dollar. So hope all is well. Hope this comes through clearly because I'm using my hands-free headset unit while driving. Oh la la, but at least my hands are on the wheel. Take care, guys. Have fun. Bye.
Thanks, Grant. Grant's always got an opinion, you know.
We should start off and say, oh, Grant, it sounded like it was going to be really interesting, but you got cut off after about 4 seconds. and Grant has a good point. And this is something we've talked about before. I agree that until pilots are not willing to work for the amount of money they're being paid, it's not a shortage. I'm just saying I think it's coming.
And if the salaries don't go up, then I think I would, you know, agree with Grant that it's not going to come. But at some point, we have to see that.
Well, and of course, the regionals will tell you, well, we can't afford anymore. Well, then you know what? They're going to go out of business.
Yeah.
And when they go out of business and the main lines, the Uniteds, the Deltas, the Americans don't have that feed for their international flights, then someone's going to say, oh, my God, how did this happen? And what do we do? Right. I really think that's about what it's going to take is some crisis.
I think so, too. All right. Neil sent us a voicemail also with some feedback. I think Neil's got a good idea here.
Hi, geeks. My name is Neil. This is the first time I've contacted you guys, but I've been listening for about a year since episode 210 or so. And I've gone backwards through the archives and listened back to about episode 180 or so, and thought I'd give you a shout on the phone line since last episode you guys said you haven't been getting many, if any, calls on the Airplane Geeks phone line. You guys are the first podcast I started listening to since in my current work I wasn't really getting the aviation fix that I needed. I'm not currently working as a pilot, though I have as recently as 2011 when I was flying a Piper Cheyenne doing some wildfire surveillance and research over the western United States and northern Alberta, northern Mexico, etc. I was hoping I'd see somebody with an Airplane Geeks button at Oshkosh this year, but Rob Mark went unseen by this geek. David, as a fellow military aviation and history buff, I just wanted to thank you for the history segment and your insights into the military topics. I grew up about 800 feet from the threshold of runway 17 at the Kalamazoo Airport, which is the home of the famous Kalamazoo Air Zoo, which I think until at least a couple years ago had the largest collection of Grumman cats anywhere in the world. Just wanted to say what a great job you guys are doing and how much I enjoyed the podcast, and offer to be part of a listener participation episode should you guys ever decide to do one. I know you've talked about it in the past. I often find myself talking to you guys in the car on my commute on the west side of Chicago. I often have an opinion or an observation or an anecdote or something to add to many of your discussions. Keep up the great work, and I'll keep listening. Look for an email pretty soon from me with my contact info, so should you guys ever want to get some sort of audience participation going in an episode. Thanks, and have a great day. Bye.
All right, Neil, thanks for that. You know, what do you guys think about a listener roundtable? I think that would be just a great idea.
Do we have any listeners that would have any opinions?
He says with a straight face. Yeah, that's not a problem at all.
And so, Neil, listen, the reason you didn't see me at Oshkosh is that I was tied to a tree right near the base of the control tower, and I was gagged for an entire week. And that's why I could not get no one. And when Neil sends his address, let's make sure we send him some buttons. He sounds like a button guy.
He was flipping burgers to pay for the tower fees.
That's right.
All right. So, yeah, we need to figure out how to do a roundtable, how to select some listeners to participate. So we got to think about that.
Do you remember when we tried? What was that thing we tried a few years ago when we were trying to do a live cast and Jeopardy. That's right. That was Dan's idea, wasn't it?
Yeah. We have some other emails. We heard from Patrick. Patrick was the guy that we described as the NASA/JPL solar system ambassador to Utah. Well, that's actually real. He says there's actually several hundred of us ambassadors spread around the country, strictly voluntary, so no pay, but we do get lots of training and it's loads of fun. And as it turns out, September is the month that they recruit new ambassadors. And we actually heard from Bill Berry on this too. Remember, Bill is the NASA chief historian that was our guest on episode 259. So we'll put a link in the show notes. It's not too tough. It's to the website, www.jpl.nasa.gov/ambassadors. And you can learn more about that program. It says it's a nationwide network of space enthusiast volunteers, and they're going to accept applications from September 1 through September 30th, 2013. And this is for a term that begins January 1st, 2014. And they also say, while applications will be sought nationwide, interested parties from the following states are especially encouraged to apply. All right, so pay attention. Here they are. Alaska, Delaware, Mississippi, Montana, Nebraska, Omaha, South Dakota, West Virginia, Wyoming, and the District of Columbia. And they're looking to add 100 new volunteers. So, again, we'll put the link in the show notes. Look for airplanegeeks.com/265. And if you're interested in participating in that, this sounds like a great thing to get involved in.
Ooh, I could do Delaware.
You could do Delaware. Yeah, you could just say Delaware. They're probably, well, never mind. I was going to make a crack about how small Delaware is, but it's not worth it. Patrick also mentioned something interesting that I wasn't aware of. Did you know that there are these large concrete arrows across the country? I'd never heard of this.
Airmail arrows.
Yeah, tell us about what those are all about, David.
Well, if you're trying to fly airmail and you don't have any radar and you have to navigate somehow, so they took these large concrete arrows and followed the Pony Express so that the pilots could navigate them. They pointed the direction to the next arrow. And that's how you navigated across the country delivering mail like Lindbergh.
I think that's pretty cool. So Patrick is involved with the local Civil Air Patrol. They're looking to clean up and preserve some of these arrows. And he's got a website that he put together with pictures and links to more information. And we'll put that in the show notes as well. It's kind of cool. I mean, these big concrete arrows across the country.
How do you shoot an arrow that big?
A really big bow, Rob. A really big bow.
Yes.
Oh, my. We heard from Jeff. Jeff was very complimentary. He just wanted to say it's an awesome podcast. He waits patiently each week. He says, Airplane Geeks and Airline Pilot Guy are my all-time favorite podcasts. I agree with that. Airline Pilot Guy is a great podcast. Everybody should be listening to that. He says the interviews are top-notch. History segments are his favorite. He also would like to hear an interview with an aircraft recovery specialist or a repo man sometime. He says he just got hooked on the new Airplane Repo on TV.
Oh, me too. I'd love to hear that too. I just got hooked on that. And my wife actually likes watching it, and she's a non-flyer, so I would be into that.
I've only seen one episode, and yeah, I can definitely see how you'd get hooked on that.
Trying to figure out how they're not getting violated, but that's a whole other topic.
I know.
I was going to say, that guy's local to me here in Chicago. He's down at Gary Airport.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, look him up.
I cannot imagine doing what he did. Of course, I was just watching an episode, and maybe one of you guys saw it too. I mean, maybe 10 days ago, and they were repossessing a Cirrus. And yeah. And they were getting the airplane started, and they needed gas, and here came the airport manager trucks with their lights going, and the race was on to get to the runway, and they blasted off just in time. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. So it was a little, you know, maybe when they're stealing the jets, I don't know, but
they got some drama built in, that's for sure. But yeah
they
it's
do.
Still interesting.
All right, thanks to Jeff for sending that in. We had a great story from a different Jeff, actually, but also Jeff. He sent a couple of paragraphs. I'm going to read this because it's a great story. And there's a link at the end to a newspaper article that goes into more detail. But basically, he says that his uncle and cousin, they were driving cross country, and they had the unique opportunity to stop in Casper, Wyoming, which is one of the sites where his grandfather's B-24 training took place. He says, unfortunately, he and his crew, being his grandfather, were one of the statistics of the war and never made it over to Europe. He says, this is interesting, David. I don't know if you knew this statistic. He says over 14,000 aircraft were lost within U.S. borders during the war years. But he says his aircraft crashed, this B-24, shortly after takeoff on one of their final training missions before heading overseas. He survived the crash, but four of his crew members unfortunately did not make it. It says, fast forward nearly 70 years, and my uncle, cousin, and the curator of the Wyoming Veterans Museum set out to find the crash site. The site had been had long been lost, but luckily our family had gotten our hands on a copy of the original crash report. That, some local knowledge from the curator of the museum, as well as some handy work with Google Maps, allowed them to pinpoint the site on their first attempt. Although the engines and other salvageable pieces were removed shortly after the crash, the rest of the plane, now in pieces, was left in place and is now lying just beneath the surface 3 miles from Natrona County Airport. It says it was a pretty amazing find given the amount of time that has gone by. What's even more amazing is to think about the sheer numbers of similar sites that still exist around our country today and the number of young men that lost their lives in them. And then he, as I said, he attached this this link to the article. Go read it. It's really fascinating. He says, on a side note, his grandfather, Richard Martis, he said he luckily made a full recovery and went on to pursue a career in aviation, flying everything from DC-3s to DC-8s for Capital and United Airlines. His love of flying was passed on, and now there are a number of enthusiasts in the family. So what a great story. I love things like that. Just amazing to, you know, to be able to find that site that has that history and something that your grandfather was involved in. So really thank you, Jeff, for passing that great story along. Okay, we have a lot of additional listener mail. So I guess, guys, I think we'll hold it and try to catch some more of it next time. I do want to thank everyone for sending it in. We've been getting to some great email, interesting topics, interesting stories, and we really appreciate it very much. We want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank Brent Owens, our guest this episode. Brent, thanks for joining us. Thanks for sticking around.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I'm a fan of the podcast and love listening to you guys. It's been really fun talking to you guys.
It's been fun having you, and you folks can find you at either fixedwingbuddha.com or iflyblog.com. Twitter was iflyblog?
That's right.
Okay. Yep. And Facebook was?
I think it's the same, iflyblog.
iflyblog. All right. Mm-hmm. Very good.
As long as people find him in the air, that's all.
That's right, yeah.
Wave as you go by.
We also want to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. You can find him on Twitter at NASCOT Hornet and his Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. Rob Mark, let's start with you.
Well, they can find me on jetwine.com. They can find me at jetwine on Twitter. They can find me at jetwine on Facebook, I think, right, David? Or it's my name or something. I don't know. I'm in a lot of places. David knows more about it than I do.
You're out of control, Rob.
Yeah, I know.
All right. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter as the UAV Digest. You could find our new podcast, the UAV Digest, or you can find me lurking around Twitter on DM Vanderhoof.
All right, good. Yeah. Hey, our new podcast, the UAV Digest, is taking off pretty well. I'd like to thank all of you listeners who have gone over there to take a listen, and we really appreciate that.
Okay, wait a minute. I have to interrupt here. I have a special bulletin because I have listened to the UAV Digest, and I want to know why you guys have to be there. Why isn't it automatic?
We could make the unmanned podcast, right?
Right. Yes, I think the unmanned... You know, unmanned aerial vehicle should be unmanned. But
okay. Well, you know, unless you're the BBC. I was listening to a BBC piece just today, and you know what their terminology was? Unpersoned aircraft.
Ooh. RPV.
That's more politically correct.
I don't know. That's just something wrong with that. All right. Well, listen, I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight, also at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. Links to all the sites we mentioned, some photos. Well, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google+. You know, an easy way to find all those is just go to airplanegeeks.com, look up there in the sort of top-ish right side, and there's little logos, little icons that'll take you to all those kinds of places. And if you want to leave us a voicemail, of course, we have a listener line, which many of you have been taking advantage of. And Benay Wilson, the aviation queen, can give you that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. All right, so join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
So, David, are you all set?
Not to rub it in, but it's 33-7 Eagles.
Oh, is it really? 33-7?
Yes.
Crap. Rob, have you flown in a glider at all? Rob's on mute. Rob's falling asleep.
Rob probably ran into the men's room.
Rob, are you there? Are you there? Rob.
What? I'm not in the men's room. Besides, I have a microphone in my men's room.
The dream does go on, and at this point, I'm going to give Chris from In the Pot and Podcast. You have to edit that one out. Let me start again. One, two, three. At this point, I'd like to give Chris from In the Pot and Podcast. Here we go again.
You're going to get into the outtakes, Neil. You know that.
Oh, all right, zip it tight. I'm going to give Chris from In the Pot and Podcast in the bottom. Oh, God. Okay, here we go.
All right, thanks, Pete. Pete. I never called him Pete in my life. Thanks, Peter.
Anybody remember Dan?
Of course. We can't forget Dan. Dan, of course, is a, for those who are new to the show, is a previous co-host who had to unfortunately leave us and move on to other things, someone that we hope can return someday.
As the Brits say, he was made redundant.
No, that's what we have in mind for you, Rob.
Oh, I see.